This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to The Commercial Investing Show, where we analyze, explain, and exploit the opportunities presented in today's commercial property marketplace. If you're interested in apartments, mobile home parks, self-storage facilities, and other income property, you've come to the right place. We'll explore what's hot and what's not in markets nationwide in the relentless pursuit of return on investment. Here's your host, Jason Hartman.
It's my pleasure to welcome Donna Salvatore to the show. She is founder and CEO of Megalytics, and I think you'll find this show to be very interesting and educational as we talk about due diligence, sort of on the tenant screening side in a different kind of a way. Donna, welcome. How are you?
Hi, Jason. How are you?
Donna, so your company is in a very interesting space. You do something that not many companies seem to do out there, where you really help buyers of property, I guess mostly, analyze that purchase before they get into it, potentially saving them a lot of bad news later because they can get a lot of additional data on the properties they're buying and the tenants that occupy them, right?
Yeah, actually, we use data and analytics to help any, not just buyers of commercial real estate, but also people who own and operate commercial real estate properties. These are, you know, institutional owners that want to reduce risk and optimize outcomes, make quicker decisions. So we've developed an automated platform that integrates and harmonizes large and disparate data sets. And then we apply proprietary algorithms and scoring models so that they can reduce risk and help clients make better and faster investment and management decisions.
That's fascinating. So how long have you been doing this?
We started the company in about 4 years ago. So we've been operating now for the last 4 years.
Uh-huh, fantastic. Talk to us, Donna, if you would, about some of these data sets. You take a pretty deep dive into some interesting areas of the big data world, right?
Yeah, we found that there's a lot more interesting data sets out there for commercial real estate that people are not aware of or have not been using. A couple that come to mind are satellite GPS tracking of people and cars. And so from a shopping center viewpoint, you want to know where your shoppers are coming from. Are they how many miles away? Are they coming just on weekends or weekdays? Do they come from work? Do they come from home? How often do they stay? How long do they stay when they're there? Where do they go to? What's the customer journey after they leave the shopping center? So there's a lot of data there. Knowing the demographics of the customers, like based on where they live, tell you a lot about the customers. Are they what are the demographics? Is it an older population, or, you know, millennials don't shop, so maybe it's not millennials. But, you know, there's also the experiential play now in retail centers, so that does, you know, pull the millennial crowd. So it's very important to know the demographics and the shoppers that are coming to your site and where they're going when they leave and what they do when they're there. So mm-hmm. We also combine that with credit card data. So we know from the credit card data, you know, at a high level what they're buying, and we also know how well the merchants are doing within a mall. So if you're buying a mall, you might want to say, how is this merchant doing versus all the other similar merchants in, say, women's apparel in the area. So we use a third data set that tells us from it's a financial and business benchmarking database that tells us how well that woman's apparel category is doing. Is it oversaturated or undersaturated in that mall area? I'm giving retail as an example, but you can use that same data for understanding office workers for an office environment. If you want to understand where the workers live that come to the office, and if you're trying to understand job creation and job demand, job aggregation, we have another data set that tracks the whole kind of talent pool heat map in an area and what you're looking at in terms of demand for jobs and office space.
Fascinating.
How far they're coming. Yeah.
So you started out with retail, at least in this conversation, you started out with talking about retail, and retail is going through some big, big shifts right now. But you also do this for multifamily apartment projects. You do it for industrial, really office space, every segment of the real estate market, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah. We are in every food group. So we work with retail, office, industrial, and multifamily. We do, I would say, with what's going on now, with all the retail stores closing, it's interesting because while there are people who are very concerned about their retail portfolio, there is a lot of retail buying going on right now. We are just got two or three orders in today to look at retail acquisitions in a certain market areas. And so we'll look at the whole rent roll analyzer. We'll just look at the retail, the makeup of the tenants. We'll look at the vacancies they have and what you might want to do for creative, new, and best highest use for those vacancies, whether it's, redevelopment or a different type of experiential retail. There's been a lot of talk about redevelopment of anchor tenants, so it's a very dynamic, interesting time right now in retail, and we have a lot of really good data sources to support that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say that in such a positive fashion. I love it. So there's a lot of retail buyers out there right now, but Donna, do you think that what so many call the retail apocalypse, has that been priced in yet? It seems like it's got a long way to go. I mean, Amazon and other e-tailers can still gobble up a lot of market share that they haven't gobbled yet. It would seem like retail is only going to get worse in my eyes, but I guess some of the players in that area don't share my sentiment there.
Yeah, I think it's the retail apocalypse is not, throughout. There are still very good A malls and, super zip areas that are doing very well. In fact, the rents are going up. There's still a lot. The B malls could go either way. But they're in general, we're overstored in the U.S. 23 gross leasable square feet per capita in the U.S. versus, Asia is in the U.K. are down at 5 or 6. So we've been overstored, plus the internet defensive, plus millennials and their shopping patterns have indicated that there's just going to be a redistribution. There's still some very strong neighborhood centers out there that will always, it seems, they're what we've seen is still some very high occupancy rates, and they're still doing very well, the neighborhood centers. There's still some issues with, the general malls and some of the power centers, but overall, there's some very strong retail segments out there.
Yeah, very, very interesting. I think the retail that works nowadays, and I think the first really large-scale example we saw of this was back many years ago with the Irvine Spectrum in Irvine, California, where they really designed that as more of a destination entertainment retail type center, and it did very well versus just a place to shop, because the utility of shopping has been replaced so much with the online component. But people still want to get out, right? They want to get out and they want to do things and they want to mingle and so forth. So that's certainly now, and in you have an interesting way of saying it, overstored. So in other words, we have too many retail stores per capita in the U.S. And that number, it's an interesting number you just shared about the square footage per person. Is that what that was? I think you said 23 square feet of retail space per person in the U.S. versus like 5 or 6 square feet in Asia and England, maybe you said? I can't remember.
Yeah, 23.5 per capita in the U.S., Canada 16.4, U.K. is 5, China is 5 or 6.
Wow, it's an amazing difference, yeah. Talk to us a little bit about multifamily. We have a lot of residential property investors that listen to the show. I'm in that world myself deeply. If someone wants to buy an apartment building, your company can help them figure out if that deal makes sense or at what price it might make sense, right? In terms of what the risk profile of the tenant base is and such?
Yes, we have, depending on whether it's pre-LOI or post-LOI, we can provide some information on the credit score, or we call it aggregated credit score, of the tenant rent roll, not individual tenants, but that would be done post-closing or very much post-LOI. But we look at...
And LOI, by the way, is letter of intent, just for those who don't know.
Yeah, right. But we look at property taxes and nearby developments, accessibility score, can you walk, walk score, transit score, bike score, can you park, distance to grocery stores, schools, banks, and We look at rent and sales comps. We've actually started to look at more property management scores and social media feeds. We look at the schools, if there's schools nearby and what the school scores are, and the amenities in the building, fitness center or dry cleaning. And we also look at last thing you want is to not know about a nearby development that might impact your rental rates. Supply demand.
Right, right. When you say you look at social media feeds and property management scores, I found those two to be quite interesting. Can you elaborate on those, Donna? What do you mean by that?
Well, there's certain websites you can go to that have information on how all the property's been managed, and there's some social media sites as well, that maybe Yelp, that has how commentary on the property management. So we use social media quite a bit in our tenant risk assessments, and that is an important component that is more qualitative, but nonetheless something that should be looked at.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When we started the conversation today and you were talking about your analysis of retail centers, you talked about looking at satellite and GPS data. Were those one and the same, Donna, or were those two separate categories? Because I know that I've heard a lot of people talk lately about looking at satellite images to literally see how many cars are in the parking lot and judge using this for stock purposes and whether or not a company is having trouble laying people off, you know, when it's private and you don't know these things and how many cars are in the parking lot every day. Now, I guess that wouldn't help if you have a virtual workforce, but you know, for customers, when you have a physical retail space, that matters. Are those different things or are those the one and the same item, that category?
No, the satellite tracking is the use satellite to track the GPS. So it's, you know, comes through your navigation system in your car or from the GPS on your phone. You can track where the vehicles are going or where the people are going. You can track fleets. People use it to track, you know, you could use it to geofence certain areas like a warehouse for, you know, advanced, you know, correlation on, you know, fleet and trucking movement at the warehouse versus sales, let's say. So there's a lot of interesting uses for that data, and it's something we're just exploring new uses in the office and retail area with that.
Very interesting. I didn't know that data was available except for maybe, you know, to the NSA or military or something. I mean, certainly, I guess, you know, a buyer could get it from a company if they're getting it on, say, their truck fleet or something. But how would you get the GPS data of a bunch of shoppers, random shoppers at a retail center?
It's through different agreements that are picked up through our data vendors. It's all, you know, aggregated. It's anonymous aggregated data. So it's, you know, there is fleet data. There's billions of signals collected every day. So it's used for traffic now. Most of the cities and governments use that for tracking the traffic patterns where there's congestion. So it's all about how long it takes to get from here to there as opposed to the distance.
Yeah.
There's more and more of that data being used on a regular basis.
And it's available to your firm to analyze. Huh? Very interesting. Very interesting. Tell us, you know, maybe something, just a question that I haven't asked you or just whatever you'd like the listeners to know.
The listeners may want to know, what are CRE, C-suite, you know, executives looking for
commercial
today
real estate, CRE,
of,
yeah. Got it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in terms of using data and analytics to make better decisions or, you know, sometimes people think, well, all this research, I'm not a big company. I'm a small guy. How do I use it? So one of the things that, you know, we provide is the ability for any, you know, kind of levels of playing field. So for whether you're a small investor or a large investor, you know, this data can be used kind of in a piecemeal basis, you know, one-off basis. You don't have to spend millions of dollars a year, even thousands of dollars a year to get the subscription, you know, pay a subscription to this. So we've made it very accommodating to the smaller investors and developers.
What does the future look like in your world, in the world of big data? Do you mind being classified as part of big data? We keep hearing that thrown around,
yeah,
and it's pretty interesting.
Big data is used quite a bit. I would say we are big data and small data.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the GPS type satellite tracking of everybody going everywhere is big data. But the actual transaction level data that we're collecting or that we're analyzing is very specific to a tenant or a property. It's small data, it's transactional data. There's a lot more data available today through government and public data sources. There's a lot more information at the federal, at the state, at the county level. And there's a lot more third-party data sources that are out there. We have over 100 data sources, maybe 200 data sources that we use on a daily basis that we pull data real-time,
What does the future look like for this world, though? I mean, in 5 years, everything you do now is only going to become more rich. You know, you're going to have more data, more sources, things we haven't even thought of yet. I mean, if we would have had this conversation 20 years ago, didn't even know what social media was back then, right?
Right. Yeah, there'll be more data sets that, a lot of the data we use today wasn't available a year ago. A lot of the data we used a year ago wasn't available 2 years ago. So companies are looking to monetize their data, whether it's, payroll data or employment data, there's just a lot of different interesting data sources out there. And we're exposed to 2 to 3 data sources a day, I would say. Just fascinating data sources. Yeah, I don't know if they were available 3 years ago. Certainly pulling that from an API has been, in many cases, we're the first with our vendors to pull real-time data feeds.
Amazing. It's just incredible. It's, as I always say, it's an amazing time to be alive. It's scary at the same time. I tell you, Google and Facebook scare me to death, maybe just as much as the NSA does, but it's the world we live in. So here we are. And it's only going to be more and more invasive. I know that IBM just signed a deal to provide all sorts of offers and context-sensitive offers to cars, to basically the smart car, if you will, where the car knows that you need new brake pads, and you'll start seeing ads on your screen in your car for brake places and just whatever you need. I mean, it's mind-boggling how rich and how context-sensitive this data is becoming, and wow. I don't even think we can imagine what it's going to be like in 5 or 10 years. It's just changing so quickly. Donna, give out your website. Tell people where they can find out more.
Yeah, it's www.megalytics.net, and you can go to info@megalytics.net if you have any questions. So we'd be happy to be challenged and to hear from people on unique situations, whether it's development or asset management or acquisitions or dispositions or portfolio management. Anything from global watch lists to adverse media sources, anything you're looking for that you can't seem to find the data, or even looking for better outcomes or analysis, that just send us an email or reach out to us.
Thank you very much for joining us today. I do want to make one comment, and Donna, before you go, you might have a comment on this for the listeners who are the smaller investors who are buying a few houses, for example. There's been a lot of talk about changing the credit scoring models and making them a lot richer. FICO score does not do it. And it's sort of parallel, Donna, to what we've talked about today, where, on every consumer, there are over 1,000 data points. And it is really interesting to see how some people with FICO scores that aren't that great would actually make very good tenants for property owners. And they have found all sorts of really fascinating connections. One that I mentioned on a previous show is just something as simple as when someone fills out a rental application or a credit application, are they lazy in the sense that they don't push the shift key and capitalize the first letter of each word? Do they type it all lowercase? Those people, believe it or not, tend to be a higher credit risk than people who are a little more uptight about it, formal about pushing the shift key. Those people are actually more responsible, they found. It's really amazing the time we're moving into, where I think we can do a much better job as landlords in tenant selection, and there are just all kinds of influences out there on people that just don't show up on a FICO score in both directions, the higher credit risk and lower credit risk direction. It's an interesting time, and this is coming, all of this sort of big data that we've talked about is coming to the single landlord that's just renting a single home, for example, to someone. It's just amazing. We're just going to be so much better at being landlords as we go down the road and this data improves. Any comments on that, Donna, before you go?
Well, yeah, I would say that to make sure, you know, as a landlord, you know, really make sure you do your background checks, because we have uncovered a lot of fraud out there, and a lot of the major credit bureaus are not, as of July 1st, because of the PIA issues and not being
What is PIA?
Well, there was a lawsuit that I think the Attorney General in New York and a lot of others joined to uncover the fact that there was, you know, somebody might have been flagged for a lawsuit, but it was the wrong name. It was Greg Brown, let's say. It was a common name or something that wasn't checked with multiple pieces of data. So there wasn't five, you know, personally identifying pieces of data that could say that this was that person. So they have cut back quite a bit on that reporting on lawsuits and background in the background check area. So you would have to go to other data sources potentially to find that, but the major credit bureaus are not putting that into the credit score starting on July 1st, and I do think that's going to increase some of the credit scores. You're going to see higher values. At the mid-range, you'll see higher scores. At the higher range, you'll see slightly higher scores. So I think that's going to impact that. So just be careful when you get a credit score, that to beware that you may need to look at other data sources.
Yeah, there's a lot more to it than FICO score, and that scoring model is so flawed, if you ask me, because it doesn't take into account your income versus your credit. So, for example, if you have $20,000 available on credit cards, and every month you run that up to $15,000, the FICO scoring model will say that you are a higher risk because you've only got $5,000 worth of credit left, and you've used a lot of your credit. But you might pay it off every month, and you might earn $2 million a year. It's just stupid. The whole model is just based on this very old idea that someone's going to have a regular corporate job, they're going to earn $50,000 a year, and it doesn't make any sense, you know? So, yeah, we need new data for a new world. Yeah, very interesting conversation.
There's a whole parallel story on that, right, on the business side. You know, business credit scores, you know, what is that really mean?
Right.
If you're like Amazon, you're a big, large company, you can, you know, pay your bills, you know, 120 days beyond terms because you can, you're going to get a lower
credit score. Because you can get away with it,
You're rock solid. So it's a kind of upside down there as well. Somebody needs to come up with a new scoring system, probably.
Yep. There's more to it than meets the eye.
And there are. We've seen alternative risk and credit scores out there that we are testing that for individuals that we think are really interesting. They don't look at what you just, you know, how much you've paid up, percent of your credit you used up every month. They do not. They look at other factors.
Right.
Which are just as relevant and tell a different story.
Sure. Good stuff. Donna, thanks for joining us.
Very good. Thank you for having me, and look forward to further discussions.
Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to check out HartmanMedia.com for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guests' opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.